Hello, everybody. I'm Dwayne Mancini, and welcome to another episode of the Project MedTech Podcast. If you need anything from us or would like to suggest a future guest, you can email us at info@projectmedtech.com. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. For more information on Project MedTech, our events we host, our consulting and advisory services, and to sign up for our monthly newsletter, visit our website, www.projectmedtech.com, and follow us on LinkedIn. If you're enjoying this content, don't forget to check out our other podcasts by searching MedTech Money on your favorite podcast platform or by heading to our website. MedTech Money is an interview-style podcast focused on demystifying raising and investing capital for medtech companies. While you're on our website, you'll also want to check out our two events we have coming up this year, our Midwest Showcase in Cleveland, Ohio on August 30th, and our Startup Symposium in Houston, Texas, October 25th through the 26th. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by Galen Data. Galen Data is an FDA-compliant cloud for medical device manufacturers. The Galen Cloud provides a configurable platform for device-to-cloud connectivity that is compliant to FDA, HIPAA, and CE mark standards. The company is ISO 13485 certified, and the product on AWS is HITRUST certified as well. Founded by seasoned medical device professionals, the company's goal is to make medical device cloud connectivity available to all at a fraction of the cost while shaving months off the development timeline. Galen Data allows medical device companies to stay medical device companies and not become IT companies. In this episode, our guest Ty Higler and I discuss industrial design, Trig, their current program called Med Plus Design by Trig, how to approach innovation for healthcare, and so much more. So without further ado, my discussion with Ty Higler.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech. Good.
All right, Ty, welcome to the podcast.
All right. Thanks, Dwayne. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So, Ty, to kick things off, introduction to who you are and what you're currently doing at Trig.
Okay, sure. So I'm Ty Higler. I'm the principal and founder at Trig. And so my undergraduate degree is industrial design from Georgia Tech, and then I have an MBA from NC State. I've been running Trig since 2008. Previous to that, I was with Home Depot's in-house innovation department, where I was there for about 4 years. And so, you know, within Trig, you know, we've been doing, as an industrial designer, you kind of have an invitation to look at a lot of different industries. But then as I was, you know, got exposed to my first medical device in probably about 2011, this was coming out of grad school. And then we've been successively making investments into this space and really kind of taking some of what we've learned from other industries and kind of seeing some interesting opportunities in the space. And so the current, program that we've been running and building momentum around has been med design, which we can jump into here, but it's pretty exciting in terms of having a different take on how to approach innovation for healthcare.
Okay. So yeah, that's exactly what I want to talk about. But before we get there, just a little more on Trig. So Trig has been around since what year did you say?
Since 2008.
Okay. Since 2008. Mm-hmm. And how many people is it? You're only working on medical devices. Just a little more detail on what Trig is.
So Trig is an industrial design consulting firm. And so we've got four people on staff, a number of contractors that, you know, we pull in. And so we do consulting for any number of different, different domains. We've done had some award-winning work we've done for consumer products. There's some new machine forms in the durable equipment space that will be coming out in 2025. There's, of course, a pretty diverse mix of medical devices and digital health companies we've worked with. So the gamut that we've run is pretty broad. Now, as our training is industrial designers, kind of we've got the core, can you think of like physical goods, industrial design work that we do that is around building up an enclosure and thinking through the human factors of that enclosure. And so that's kind of the classic, you know, product design, product development work that we do. And then leading up to that, the two key inputs for a successful product design is one, having the research, the insights, the design strategy to really have a good foundation, and are you really solving an unmet need? And so that's one third of our business is around doing that strategy and research work. And the other side is, you know, oftentimes there isn't a good brand in place. And so, you know, sometimes we'll either go through and either build up a new brand. Let's say we've been working with a client where their branding is basically a science poster, and to help build one from scratch, or we'll go through and, like, let's say in the case of some work we did for Zeiss, we made sure that the design we did flowed into the visual brand language that Zeiss had. So it looked like it was an existing product that came out of the design studio in Germany, but it fit the overall look and feel of it. So, you know, brand and insights are two core inputs to good design. And so we've really, that's kind of the scope of our services. And then the new mix that we have in here is the just kind of this emphasis. We've always had a heart for teaching. And so we've been increasingly incorporating more education into our work so that as our clients come alongside of us and don't have any familiarity with good design or good brand work or good research, that we include that training as part of our engagement. And so that's something that, like, the clients are coming away not just with a better deliverable, but also kind of a better understanding of the context for it, so that they can, you know, like, take some parts of this and be able to practice, the profession a little bit on their own. So,
yeah, that's, it's really interesting you kind of brought that up. So we've had these conversations, you know, within Project MedTech as we grow our consulting advisory practice, and it's like, okay, well, where are we going to find certain consultants for this? And it's like, well, maybe our clients, right? After they've kind of run their course or wherever they're at. I mean, if you've done a good job, you've probably educated them pretty well, mm-hmm. or at least got that they're in the same mindset that you are when it comes to how you deal with this. And so I think that's really cool that that's how you're thinking about it as well, and bringing that educational piece to that with your clients, because that's really important. Because the more educated your clients are on your processes and what you're doing, the better relationship it's going to be. So I'd love to hear about the Med Plus Design Program. So, well, Trig runs a bunch of programs in general, right? I mean, you do a lot of these kind of like project development or product development coursework and that kind of thing. So maybe start at that high level and then dive into the new program, Med Plus Design. And before you do that, I do have to give a shout out to Joe Hage for this one, because Joe is where we had met at the 10X Medical Device Conference last year. And Ty gave a really interesting presentation. I probably couldn't comment too much on it other than the fact that it was on product design. But the one thing I do remember is he bounced a red ball for the first minute or so of the presentation, or almost the entire thing. And that will be stuck in my head forever. And that's what I'll always remember. So I remember Ty presented on product development with the red bouncing ball. Ty, feel free to comment on any of this, and then also dive into the product development side and Med Plus Design.
The neat thing about the bouncing ball, that's the one and only time I've done that particular bit for a talk. I'm usually trying different things every time I give a talk. But for that one, it was interesting because at the start of the talk, I was able to engage basically your sense of memory, because I tied it into A Wrinkle in Time. And a scene in The Wrinkle of Time, in Time, where all of the children walk out and bounce a red ball at the same time. And so you're engaging memory, you're engaging visual, you've got the smell of that rubber red ball, and you've got the auditory of that. And so the reason why it sticks in your brain is because it hits so many different aspects of your cognitive psychology that it's just embedded permanently in your head as, like, you've never seen that before. And hopefully we don't have mobs of people coming out bouncing red balls now that that's been started.
I should have made it a requirement. You spoke at our Houston Startup Symposium last year. I should have made a requirement for you to be on the panel that you bounce the red ball every time you spoke, which you'll probably be at this Houston Startup Symposium this mm-hmm. year. And so I'll make sure we bring a red ball for you that people
remember
that. Or some
kind of bit or something like that. Because if you do it too many times, then it becomes rote, right?
Right on. So anyways, let's talk about the programs you run, and then more specifically the MedPlus design program. That's your newest one, right?
Yeah, well, it's the culmination of a lot of work we've done. So in 2015, Andrew DeMeo, who he's one of the originators of biodesign. He was part of the original content, or, working with Paul Yock to develop biodesign. He was running the curriculum for a program called Culture College, which was started through the Wallace H. Coulter Foundation. And so it was basically a startup weekend where, rising senior biomedical engineering students from 10 different universities across the country would come together. They would have researched a need statement. And over the course of the weekend, the students would then, go through, do like regulatory reimbursement, clinical, assessment of these ideas that they had, and then ultimately culminating in a, basically VC style pitch on Sunday afternoon before everybody flies home. And the invitation we had was to have some industrial designers come out, and it was kind of question mark of like, what can industrial design add to this? And so we jumped in and started doing basically our design process and just folded in with the students and helped provide the visuals for the students to then express their idea quickly and concisely. And so first time we did it, I think the organizers were, went from being very skeptical to then realizing the value of design in healthcare innovation, such that we were incorporated into coming up with the curriculum and making suggestions, so that by the last time that Culture College was facilitated, I think we had a solid full day of the 3-day program. We were helping to infuse creativity and iteration and lean prototyping methods into the curriculum, so that by the end of it, the students had pretty well fleshed out concepts that were concisely and clearly illustrated. And so that to me was really interesting. And we've since done a lot of, guest lectures for a lot of the different biomedical engineering programs around. And so that's interesting because the healthcare innovation space, as defined through biomedical engineering as a discipline, is unique from what you see in a lot of other spaces. I come from home improvement, and that space is very much market pull driven, where you're interested more in what the consumers are doing. And then you're kind of matching up technologies based on, what the market demand is, versus healthcare innovation seems to be very technology push, where you're starting with a proprietary technology of some kind, and then you're going out and trying to do pattern matching for what basically healthcare problems can emerge. That seems to be the predominant model. So about 2 years ago, Andy Kant with UNC Health's Translational Research Group, Fast Tracks, approached us, and we've been doing a lot of collaboration with UNC Health, and said, we're looking to do clinician engagement. Is there anything we can put together that is a version of some of the design thinking workshops that we've been putting together? And so this was during the height of COVID, and we were experimenting with this. And so we put together basically a trial run of this over 5 weeks. We then had 4 teams of clinicians who were interested in innovation, interested in entrepreneurship, raise their hands and sign up for this course that we put on. And so then we sped run them through basically a design thinking process where by the end of it, they were doing a pitch day of their testable concept. And then from there, they were then able to then go forward and quickly validate those ideas. And the only investment they made was a little bit of their time and some of the engagement with designers to get to a point of, is this idea going to work or not? Some of those ideas continued to develop. Others had a quick kill, which you think about the millions of dollars of investment that could go into developing a prototype and really thinking it through versus just having a quick concept sketch to be able to validate that. There was an enormous amount of benefit to that. The other thing that was cool was that we were going through the third wave of COVID, and these were clinicians that were getting clobbered at the hospital. And the engagement we got was that they were continuing to persevere and stick with the program because it was fulfilling something deeper for the physicians as far as what we were doing. So we knew we were onto something. Of course, speed running that content through 6 weeks, we got a lot of feedback that this was way too fast. And so we've then been iterating. So we're currently in our 4th crank of this. of having, you know, brought teams of clinicians and academic researchers through the program, and then making sure the curriculum clearly communicates and the cadence of it makes sense so that it can easily be managed in about 2 to 3 hours of their time each week, because that cadence and timing of the presentation of the material is key. So some other things the value of this is that you're getting disparate stakeholders from a lot of different aspects of healthcare to come together and really find agreement on what the problem is. Because if you have a team of experts together and you start asking what the problem might be, you're going to have tons and tons of discussion around that, because the experts know all of the exclusions and caveats. And that's not just a one and done interview that you can post, but rather it's having that rich, nuanced depth of really trying to deeply understand a problem. And then once you've then gone outside of that group and validated that, then you can start to come up with solutions. Where I think too often we come in from a technology framework and say, what are all the different ways that we could apply this technology? And like, yeah, okay, we might find some different applications to it. But some of the things we've been learning as we've been doing this market pull approach is that in some cases, it's better to remove technology from the equation if the interest is in providing better care and then also having better physician experiences. And I think a technology push framework won't allow you to get to that answer. So along the way, we've had some interesting results in terms of, you know, some ideas are continuing to develop and they're under NDA. Some have been killed really quickly, which is interesting because now the group can pivot and work on their next idea. In some cases, we've got one team that used the results of the workshop to win a $5 million grant to further their research, because they were able to demonstrate to the grant awarding organization that they had traction and they had a collaborative team of multidisciplinary stakeholders who were on the same page about what the problem is and were willing to make productive progress on the grant. So it's interesting to see the results come out of this. And so next week, the week of March 3rd. So we're going to be doing pitch day for our current cohort. And so then we're seeing kind of the next results of this come out with these different teams that are coming through this workshop, and then hoping to see some of the impact of that as we continue to, you know, kind of build a common understanding and language around a new approach to innovation using an empathy first framework. So.
Yeah, so this is really interesting. There's a lot there. The empathy framework that you just kind of mentioned at the end there. So this is the idea that you're really starting with the problem, and whether this is going to be a better physician experience, correct? I mean, is that kind of like, what's the framework of that? Just instead of starting with an innovation though, you're more or less starting with the problem first, figuring out, I'm guessing maybe becoming a historian of the problem, right? Figuring out how it was solved in the past. I mean, is that kind of the idea here, or walk me through a little bit of this?
Yeah. So it's kind of, you think about like two different ways of looking at opportunity spaces. One is technology push, where you start with a proprietary technology. With market pull, you're starting with proprietary customer insight. So it's the having a unique way of looking at the problem space. And so, So the way we start is, you know, there's an application at md.trig.com where, you know, the providers then propose problems that they're personally passionate about. So that's kind of our first filter, is that, you know, we're then looking at what's the type of problem are you looking at? And then from there, we're then asking them to, let's further break this down, because the two different types of problems that we've seen as we've done multiple teams is that some of them come in with a very narrowly defined medical device of I'm solving a very specific narrow problem. And so then as we're working with them to scope that problem, we're then asking them to broaden back out and look at, well, what's happening beforehand? What, like, you know, where does the package for this come in? You know, how are you disposing of this? Is there anything we can do from a sustainability standpoint? Just open up the broader story behind a specific device. And there's other programs that come in where the team is asking a clinic improvement problem, where they're seeing problems that are happening at a behavioral level with patients. And so then we're taking a big, broad, and seemingly intractable problem, and then breaking it down into further bite-sized achievable problems that we can then scope down. So we're seeing those kind of two different partitions that are happening. And so both of which are valid. I think it's an interesting aspect of, like, you know, clearly delineating what the opportunity is. And then from there, we're asking them to go through and do what we call journey mapping, or setting up swim lanes and clearly defining each of the stakeholders and then what their respective experience is at each step along the way. So then you have, once you have a clear journey map, you're then going through and doing what we call empathy statements of looking at where are those common pain points in the journey map. Because it's not just one moment, it's multiple moments where, like, the big opportunities lie. And if you have multiple stakeholders who are each experiencing a pain point at a given point in the existing process, then that highlights some of your biggest opportunities for improvement. So you can derive your need statements from your empathy statements, making it more emotionally neutral. And then we go through and prioritize those need statements using a framework called levels of alignment. So we're trying to figure out, so at the highest level, what's our big vision, mission, and then kind of like program level aims, and then overall potential products we could use, and then underlying technologies underneath that that might apply. But we're trying to not include solutions yet, but clearly try to get a definition for what the problem actually is. You know, part of this,
Oh, no, I was just going to say, while you're still here on this part. So how much of this are you going through, like, in the problem statement, a very much of like, okay, here's the issues. When do you start talking about, okay, if there was a solution here, who's going to pay for this, right? Do you kind of walk through some of that as well? Because that's a complication in healthcare. But is that more later on? So that's probably a later on discussion then?
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem with so much of healthcare is that there's so many layers to each of these issues. And I think if you try to overwhelm the team with too much around, you know, financial viability at the upfront part of it, then you distract from making sure this is something that's actually desirable, that you're actually going to have a better outcome.
Got it.
Right. And so that's something that if you can get validation for, you know, yeah, we're going to worry about that later and have that be something we can adapt. But currently, let's just focus on, you know, what is the key pain point and then what can we do to address that? And then from there, then let's figure out, okay, how do we wrap an economic model around this? I mean, similar to, say, like Google search, you know, got started first is let's deliver value to the market. And once we've done that, now let's figure out how can we wrap a business model around this that's scalable. I think it's just it's a matter of order of operations, because you have to make sure you pay attention to regulatory reimbursement models, intellectual property. Those are all important, but they don't have to all happen at once and at the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Good to know. Yeah. Awesome. And so this program you're describing, then this is the new Med Plus Design program, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Very cool. Yep. So before I interrupt you, because I just wanted to ask about, you know, where that kind of fit in for your journey mapping and whatnot. And so what's the next step? I know you were still discussing things before I rudely interrupted you.
No. I mean, it's a lot to unpack. I mean, we've spent a lot of time thinking about this and trying to figure out a logical journey to this. So we actually take a break. So we conclude at the end of empathy, where we say, you know what, this is where we can have a stop point, because you do have teams that after a little while, you might say, you know, we're actually not solving the right problem, or we need to go back and challenge our assumptions, because it's not just a linear path straightforward to commercialization. So we ask them to then go out and then ask other people, like, is this unmet need you've identified truly an unmet need? So before we even get into solutions, we're asking them to go out and, like, just talk to people outside of your group who are colleagues, and say, do you also agree that this is a problem? And those that then come back and say, yes, we've gone out and done this homework, we've talked to other people, and here's how we've changed our unmet need by having talked to other people, you get around the me marketing problem, where, I mean, I've worked on catheter design handles that were based on one surgeon who was a golfer, and the design of the catheter handle made sense to somebody who played golf, but to nobody else, right? So,
yeah.
Like, right, you run into that all the time.
Yeah, it's important, right? I mean, we talk about this, the whole, a lot of this is like voice of customer, right? Mm-hmm. Discovery. And a lot of this, you know, we'll talk to customers all the time who will say, now this is later stage. This is, mm-hmm. they've identified everything, right? And they'll talk about, okay, well, what hospitals are going to go after first? And I said, well, you know, like just because the Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, Sloan Kettering, I don't know, name a major institution, just because they might not want your product or have a need for your product, that doesn't base your success. I mean, that's like 15% of the hospitals in the US. The other 85% might still find your service valuable, and the problems within those hospital systems are different. So I think to your point, talking to other clinicians throughout the ecosystem in different types of hospitals, whether it be a community hospital, a level one trauma center, or a specialty hospital, is really important, because it's either a good thing or a bad thing for you. Either you've developed a problem that only one hospital needs, which might not be a bad thing, but could limit your business a bit. Or, you know, one of the main hospitals said it really wasn't a big problem, but turns out it's a massive problem for the rest of the healthcare system. So I love that you kind of bring that up early. Keep going. I have two more questions, but they're not relevant yet. So
okay.
Keep going.
Yeah. Well, the other part to this is, because it's driven by the physicians, the clinicians who are experiencing these uh-huh. everyday problems, then if they're the ones who are continuing to champion this, then, you know, they're going to be the ones who can best influence some of those purchase decisions. So we're starting with that as a foundational assumption, because, you know, any meaningful healthcare innovation does truly start with the physicians and clinicians who are on the front lines, who are recognizing that change needs to happen. And they're also experiencing the complete total of different solutions they're engaging with. Because if something doesn't integrate with the electronic health records in the right way, then it's making them have a bad day. And so they're acutely aware of those pain points. So having that physician founder be a part of originating the idea is also a good BS detector. So that's just kind of something that we try to have as like a foundational framework. Because I think those moments where you do have somebody who truly understands the problem space can help you more quickly filter through and iterate on different solutions. Now, of course, at the same time, you do also want to be pulling in team members from outside of the space who can, you know, propose novel and original ideas into the problem and open up the range of solutions, so that you don't just kind of fall in love with your first idea. But that's getting into the creativity module. At the empathy module, we've gotten to where we've got a really crisp, clear definition of the problem, which very, very few entrepreneurs who I've talked to deeply understand that, or even value that exercise of going through and clarifying and validating the unmet need. But that's also foundational to your design history file. So once you've got that, then so much of the rest of the work becomes easy, because we're not having to back up and clarify, what are we really working on? Why are we in love with this specific idea? Which usually when I'm talking with inventors, usually saying, I don't like the solution you came up with, but the problem you're trying to address is interesting. So the curriculum's trying to streamline some of the work we're doing anyways from a consulting and coaching standpoint of, yeah, I see what you did here with this first prototype, but let's make sure we clearly understand what the problem is you're trying to solve. Okay. So then in the creativity module, so we found that with the empathy module, that can largely be driven by the research, clinical, and physician teams. And then from the creativity module, that's where we found that the clinicians are participating in that group, but having professional designers come in who are creative for a living, who have the creative flywheel spinning at 95 miles per hour, versus everybody else who might be slower at doing that, right? So coming in and adding some of that horsepower, we start off with lateral thinking. So we've done all of this work to zero in on a crisp, clean, defined, very narrowly converged need statement. And then we introduce deliberately ridiculous ideas to try to prime and open things back up further. Because if you if you're so narrowly confined on the problem, then all you can think of is the next incremental step forward. Rather, if we're coming in, we're asking, okay, well, what if a good example of this is I was in an ideation session for dental chairs, and specifically the hydraulic systems for those dental chairs. And so the need statement had been, you want this S curve of like a slow start and then, you know, like accelerate up to a smooth movement and then a slow stop. So you couldn't do much with that creatively. So the challenge statement that I proposed to the team was, what if we thought of the dental chair as an amusement park ride and we threw the patient up in the air and perfectly caught them again? And so it got a ridiculous laugh out of everybody on the table. And then, like, that's ridiculous, Ty's stupid. And so, but the thing is, the next comment that was made by one of the engineers that was sitting at the table was, okay, well, it's not as dumb as Ty's idea, but let me throw something else out there. And he wouldn't have had the psychological safety to throw that idea out there if I hadn't thrown something out there that's ridiculous. But that wound up being one of the winning ideas behind the proprietary program that came out of that. So it's having fun, being ridiculous, in service of making it so that you're opening up the array of concepts that you're exploring through. Because the mindset shift is from you know, most of your clinical experience is you want to always be right. But from a design thinking, from a creativity standpoint, you only have to be right once. That you can go through lots of different, you know, like in hindsight, bad ideas, but you won't know that as you're going through it until you apply convergent judgment thinking after you've developed lots of options. And then you can then start to come up with novel ideas as a result of all of this creative excess, because you've then filtered down to some of those that, going back to that need statement we've been grounded in, we can pass through that filter and then say, okay, now we've got something. And we wouldn't have gotten to that if not for the adventure we've gone through of being willing to consider lots of different ideas. So from a probabilistic standpoint, you think about, say, the first idea you come up with versus the 300th idea you come up with. How likely is it your first idea is your best idea? Very, very low. So you want to have a wealth of ideas to choose from to then be able to make good decisions going forward. All right, let me pause there.
This is great. So the ridiculous ideas piece. Well, actually, let me back up. So you talk about problem a lot, right? We're starting with problem. This lines up with exactly how early stage med tech investors invest capital, right? If you talk to, you know, we run our whole MedTech Money series here at Project MedTech. And there isn't I don't know if I've had a single investor disagree with the statement that they are investing in problem and team first and foremost. And then way down the list in importance is technology, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's still important, but it's much further down the list when it comes to those two. So I wanted to highlight that point because I thought that point that you brought up there was really, really solid. The ridiculous ideas piece, I love this idea because really what you're hitting on is some of the work that... Are you familiar with Danny Kahneman and Amos Tversky?
Yes. Thinking Fast and Slow, I happen to...
There you go. So Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky are two of my favorite authors. I think Amos Tversky passed away a little while ago, but Danny Kahneman has certainly continued to write, and so he has a number of different books out there. But they all center around judgment, decision making, and then their big thing they did together was behavioral economics. Mm-hmm. And so there's thinking fast and slow. There's noise is a good one. And then if you really just want to read about them in general and get like a lot of like snippets, if you want like a high level overview, there's a book by Michael Lewis called The Undoing Project that is just really, really good. It's the same author who wrote The Blind Side, Moneyball, The Big Short, all these other really kind of famous books that are good. So anyways, I wanted to bring that up because there's so much to what you said, where you said you threw out this ridiculous idea and it made everyone comfortable bringing up some other ideas. And there is a lot to that. And I think, you know, for people who want to be innovators, for people who want to be leaders of companies, understanding decision-making, judgment, behavior is really important. So I bring up these books quite frequently on the podcast, but when you were saying that, it's like this is something out of Danny Kahneman's book. And of course, people can't see this because this isn't a video podcast, but when I brought up Danny Kahneman, Ty held up the book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And so it's
happened to have it sitting next to me here.
yeah. So anyways, I wanted to highlight those two points. That's what I had written down. I still have one more question that wasn't addressed just yet, but I'm going to save it because I have a feeling you're going to get to it in one of these next modules. So keep going.
Yeah. Well, there's a number of books written about creativity, of course. One of which is The Creative Conspiracy by Lee Thompson. And I ran across, it's not a really well-known book, but she came up with the concept of brain writing. And that has fundamentally changed how we go about doing ideation sessions. And it gets back to what we'll call cookie monster groups. And so this idea that brainstorming was originated back in the 1950s, where, you know, it was an ad agency guy that's, you know, former military who said, you know, we should have a bunch of people storm the problem like we're storming the beaches and just like have like a room where everybody's throwing crazy ideas out there. And so so you have all kinds of, you know, sticky notes flying everywhere and everything. And the research actually doesn't support doing brainstorming sessions. In fact, there have been multiple studies that have been done. And so brainstorming groups, let's say you have a group of four people in a room that are all brainstorming and basically, you know, talking, then those groups are 1/4 as effective as nominal groups. So think of like Cookie Monster, Om Nom Nom nominal groups, right? That are like, you know, basically heads down, focused and generating as many ideas as they can, you know, kind of, you know, the introverts rejoice because you actually have heads down time to like be able to generate ideas versus the more extrovert kind of like one person's talking, but the principle of production blocking, that means if one person's talking and the other people are listening, you're blocking the people who are listening from coming up with ideas. And so that's where the methodology we have, which is called heads down, heads up, which is where we, you know, get a group of people in the room. We say for the next 10 minutes to 15 minutes, you are going heads down and you're generating as many ideas as you can. I used to run experiments on students where I'd go through and give these lectures and whatnot. It sounds funny when you say that, but
safe experiments.
There wasn't an IRB, you know, don't catch me. But what I do is I ask them to come up with as many ideas as they could in a 10-minute period, and I'd give the same problem of like, hey, how do we solve, you know, keeping an EpiPen on your person? And so we'd, you know, go through and see what, you know, how many ideas the students would come up with. And what I found was that if I prompted them with, hey, there's a competition, and, you know, the Duke BME students came up with 10 ideas per person per 10 minutes, and then challenge the students with that, I wound up getting up to 17 ideas per person for 10 minutes. And it was, The fascinating thing about that was that the quality of the ideas on the group that came up with that many ideas was better than what we had for other groups. And I did this for like, you know, kind of student groups of 100 different BME students down to smaller groups and kind of played with the format of that. But it was absolutely fascinating to see that you could get that kind of creative performance. And the interesting thing was that you could also do that online. So if you think about facilitating ideation sessions and getting creative performance out of people, the divergence of generating lots of ideas is really something that can happen privately and in your own space. But then when the heads up period comes in, this is where you benefit from getting the socialized feedback and getting the best of both worlds, but you're also having equal inclusion from everybody on the team to make sure everybody's voice is heard. And then we go through and actually do the convergence work. That's where the in-person value comes in, because then you're collectively making meaning and generating like good decisions about which of these many ideas are we then going to filter down and get to, say, the best solution. And so that's, you know, kind of how we're seeing some of the creative performance dynamics come into play. And so some of what we're doing has been pretty novel for what you kind of traditionally see in the just kind of healthcare in the innovation space. So
let's pause there. Is there anything else beyond this one or no?
Oh yeah. Then there's like prototyping, but
okay. So let's pause here then. So the innovation and convergence piece, it wasn't like I did this intentionally, right? Like again, when I talk about Project MedTech, and how we founded the company and how we did things, I always attribute a certain level of this to just like dumb luck, right? Like this is how we found out to work together, and this is how it did. So when Aaron is one of my co-founders, Rich is the other. Aaron was the first one in though with me. He was the first person I asked to kind of help me, and the way we worked really well together was not to say, hey, let's have a working meeting where we're going to work through some of these things together. It was always, Aaron, I'm going to word vomit a bunch of ideas on a piece of paper, and then I'm going to hand it to you, and you take what you word vomited down and kind of operationalize this a little bit and organize it, because that's what he's good at. He is operationally excellent. And I'm not, right? Like I can organize things in my head that make sense for me. But I know where my strengths are, where my weaknesses are. He's much better at that than me. And so we would work really well together. And when we tried to do working sessions too early, they were a complete waste of time. But when we did this almost like what you just described of innovation and convergence, it worked really well for us. And so we've kind of continued that habit of me putting a bunch of ideas down, him kind of cleaning that up, and then us meeting together and kind of formalizing things. And while we're not creating a physical medical device, we're creating work products, where we're creating a company, we're creating ideas. And so it's the same thing, but it's just funny when you said that, I'm like, that's exactly what we do. And we've tried both ways, and this way worked way more effective. So anyways, I wanted to highlight that because I thought that was really cool.
Add to that, what you just described also is different creativity styles. Mm-hmm. So there's actually four. So there's a generator who is really good at getting things started. They're very rare in corporates because they get, you know, frustrated and leave, because if you're constantly generating ideas, there's no place for them to go in the big corporates, right?
He just described why I left and started Project MedTech.
So you might be a generator if...
It might be a generator, yeah. All right.
So then there's the conceptualizer, who takes what the generator comes up with and then is good at combining those ideas around. I tend to test very high on the conceptualizer profile.
Yep.
Then there's the optimizer, who then takes these concepts and then figures out how to structure them to be a good project. And then there's the implementer, who says, okay, I see everything that we've done so far, but I'm going to tell you how to actually get it done. And so you need that mix of those four different approaches at different points in time in the innovation process. And you also want to have a mix on your team, like you just described with you and Aaron. There's a productive mix of generator, conceptualizer, optimizer, implementer, that has that back and forth as you're paddling that back and forth. And I think that good innovation teams do have that mix, because, you know, so often I think in healthcare, it's pretty predominantly implementers. And then you have your frustrated, like could have been a rocket scientist, could have been an aerospace engineer, kind of like was hoping to do some like, you know, like novel innovation work, but then kind of figured out that, you know, basically the work as a physician doesn't allow that much creativity. And so you then kind of see some of these frustrated physician entrepreneurs emerge because they've got just such like, you know, kind of that, you know, conceptualizer generator approach that they're looking for that outlet. So yeah, I think just having that good balance on your team, so that you're getting things started, but then also coming alongside so you understand, well, what are we really working on, so you can actually go through and put that into place. And you see this dynamic happen in, you know, like any different industry. And for some of our big corporate clients, we'll actually have them go through and do a personality test or a creativity test, just to make sure we're balancing out the room, to make sure if you have too many implementers at a table, then, you know, they're just kind of looking for a to-do list. If you have too many generators, they kind of float off into, you know, kind of like abstract land. So you kind of want to have that, you know, tangible mix and productive conflict. so that you have like a meaningful discussion and have, you know, kind of productive, you know, creative conflict. So,
yeah, it's great. It's great. Awesome. So let's chat about prototyping.
Yeah. So we use it when you think about prototyping, probably what comes to mind is been a lot of buzz for the past 20, 30 years about additive prototyping. So doing 3D printing where you build something up. And so there's this allure to it of, you know, going through and like you get somebody to build a CAD model, then you then send it over to the printer like you do like your laser printer, and you just print out a version of it and you see what happens. That in practice can be time consuming to get right, particularly if you're thinking about a complex device. So prototyping, all a prototype is the minimum amount that you can do to test out an idea so that somebody else can go through and evaluate your idea and then figure out, like, does this make sense? And so when we go through and teach prototyping, that's something where we're trying to make sure that we're super clear about this, because too often when particularly if we're talking to a client, they hear prototype and they think, oh, this is the thing I do right before I go to manufacture. And like, no. It's really, you're like, if you've spent that much money on that prototype, it's not really a prototype. You're assuming you're doing a carbon copy of something else that exists. Then you can go to manufacture. If you do something that's truly new, you're trying to do a series of safe fail experiments to be able to test your assumptions and reduce uncertainty and risk. Because initially, you want to be learning the lesson for as low cost as you possibly can. So through that definition, a concept sketch, a storyboard, is a prototype. Because it's the cheapest way to represent an idea so somebody else can understand it and then give you feedback on it. And that can then become your pom-pom. You know, some clients we've worked on have taken a concept illustration of what the use case is and been able to raise a couple $1 million, you know, with that as like the key story that then tells where they're going. And then, of course, you've got a lot of other, like the team, the validation, but that can help to kind of crystallize what it's about in a single beautiful image. And so then from there, then like, okay, we've got validation, we've de-risked the part that's going to be, you know, like the highest risk part of it, then we write up a prototype plan of, you know, here's the assumption we want to test. In order to be able to test that hypothesis, then we're going to go out and build a certain scale of prototype that either is either an ergonomic prototype, you can do more feasibility where you're testing, like, you know, will this, you know, breadboard technology make sense, and go through and test those assumptions with the prototype. So you're doing each of them in part, either function or looks like or feels like, before you're kind of combining those aspects together. And one of the biggest risks we see from a prototyping standpoint is that there's the assumption that there's a linear progression. In some cases, that it's better to go back in resolution if you're coming up against a problem, and do, like, if you're doing like a whole lot of, say, like, you know, like 3D printed parts, maybe it's better to go back and do like a foam model just in order to test a specific aspect of it. Like, okay, yes, no, does this make sense? Okay, now we can go forward on our progression. So in some industries, that's called an engineering validation prototype. So it's testing subsystems as you go. So we don't get into the full gamut of all of the different prototyping options you could do. But for purposes of what could go into, say, an SBIR grant application, go and appeal for like investor funding, where you've got a theory of how we're working, but also a general approach for these are the things we're hoping to be able to do. Here's a quick synopsis of our solution. And then also here's how we're going to go about going through and reducing risk in your investment without spending, you know, like tens of thousands of dollars on prototypes to learn the same lesson you could have done with a quick concept sketch. So a lot of what we do is teach how to tell those stories and be able to compose these storyboards. And then that helps to set, you know, problem, context, you know, what the technology might be, because you can wave your hands and say, yeah, we're going to integrate AI here and provide a probabilistic diagnosis on this. And that just lives in a storyboard. We haven't actually sat down and tried to figure out how we're going to get the AI to provide the diagnosis. We're just describing what this could be. And then from there, you can then have lots of people come in and tell you why that won't work. but you've done it at a pretty low cost initial prototype. So let me pause there because I'm sure you have a reaction to that.
No, I think this is great. Look, when it comes to design and prototyping and things like that, my role within Project MedTech is not on the operations, product design, supply chain, logistics sides, right? That's what where Aaron supports a lot of our companies. And when we say we do that, we're talking about like product messaging and supply chain logistics, bill of materials analysis, like more of the operations, but owning it internally for you, because most of our clients are using a contract manufacturer. The biggest hiccup I always saw, or the biggest error I always see, is design for manufacturing failure, right? Mm-hmm. Where they've prototyped, turns out it's not very manufacturable, or you can't make it as cheap as you wanted it to, so you kind of miss the price point. I'm guessing that's a little bit later on in your process, correct?
Yeah, and that's at a point where you at least understand, you've identified what the ideal is.
Right.
Which is one level of just, you know, like making sure you get the desirability aspect of this right. And then on the feasibility side, then you're figuring out what's good enough.
Right.
And that's where you're then, you know, engaging with a sourcing group to then figure out, you know, which manufacturer can make the trade-off decisions to get to a cost-effective version of the ideal that's yep. minimally acceptable. But you kind of need to know what the ideal is you're building towards first. And yeah, I mean, if you're having assumptions in there, like, yeah, we're going to negate gravity, then yeah, that's probably not very feasible. Like, let's wait on that one.
Yeah. Right. And see, I think that's the most important thing about product design here is, and where you start to see the overlap probably, is now you've kind of went through this whole process. Now we can kind of think about, okay, well, what's version one? What's version two? Mm-hmm. What do we go to market with? And why? And now we start to have some more in-depth conversations there. So, no, it makes total sense. And I can see the overlap. Is that kind of where the program ends then, or does it continue from there?
Yeah, I mean, the culmination of the program as we currently have it is a pitch day where, okay. you know, there's, you know, the problem definition concept.
Yep.
Then we then have a framework we use called rabbit holes and no-goes, where we identify rabbit holes of like, okay, yeah, we know we need to go through a reimbursement process, a regulatory process. We know that the materials for this need to fit a certain price point. Those are rabbit holes to be done later versus no-goes, which are like, you know what, we're just not going to negate gravity. So, or like that might be a question that comes up with, you know, whatever it is you're working on, like something that yeah. is outside the scope of your program. And then we're also yep. kind of look at, okay, what's our roadmap and get onto the discipline of building out a roadmap. And then potentially, are we doing product versioning? Because we want to have multiple ideas at this point that are shots on goal. And so we're going to test this idea first. We think this could be our MVP. And then there's a progression of if this works, then we build upon it with our second prototype or second product launch. And so that you've got a meaningful way of continuing to add value into the market versus kind of being a one and done. So, and that's kind of where the program ends. And then we work with the teams to then go through, try to attract grant funding and then turn into a going concern, where it just started with kind of somebody with a, you know, an identity who has identified a problem in the market. So,
yeah, very cool. Okay. So what, first of all, how does someone find this program? How does someone apply to this? Where are you running them? How many do you do a year? Give me that general information.
Yeah.
For those people listening.
So it's entirely run online. So we've got a curriculum of pre-recorded content. And then so you can go to MD, so meddesign.trig.com. So MD.trig.com. And then there's an easy application that you can fill out there. For the empathy workshop, you know, we do ask that you have you as part of your criteria, you're able to identify a problem and that you can convince one other person to work on that problem with you. Okay. So we don't do solopreneurs. Like it's, you know, you have to start by like building up
a team.
Yep. And, okay. And then from there, we've also been building up a cadre of biomedical design coaches who are mid to late career, seasoned professionals who understand what this looks like and can work with these teams because there's an hour of coaching each week as you go through the curriculum. And so then we're just kind of building this out. So, you know, we are recruiting for our next cohort, which would start March 1st, which is coming up pretty quick. Then we have that, you know, we're accepting people coming in on a rolling basis. Most of our work so far has been through the UNC health system. And so we're opening that up more broadly to teams from across the country. So,
cool. Okay. Yeah. And what is the cost to do the program?
I mean, we start off at like $900 to go through the course. And so, it's not, you know, a big, you know, break to the bank for the empathy module.
Yep.
And so then you get through, kind of get a feel for it. Do you have something? And then if it makes sense to do a further investment, then that kind of steps up from there. But it's trying to make it so that people get used to the process of defining problems. And kind of starting to change the culture and the training for, you know, how a lot of what happens is just about every conversation we have with, you know, somebody who has an idea in the healthcare space, and we're having to back them up to go back and talk, you know, to understand their problem. It just make it so we've got a good system for clearly delineating that so that you start with the right foundation.
Yep. Yeah, very cool. Awesome. Ty, I don't have anything else. I will link Trigg's website into the show notes here. I will link the md.trigg.com, right? In the show notes as well. So if people listening in, you can go to the program and apply, check it out, whatever you want to do there. You can also check out Trigg for those who aren't interested in the program, but interested in Trigg. I'll put Ty's LinkedIn in the show notes. And Ty, anything else in closing?
Just that really appreciate what you're doing there, Dwayne. I think the Project MedTech community you're building is awesome, and appreciate you including us as part of this. And just thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So Ty, hang on for a minute, we'll chat offline, but thanks so much for your time today and educating us on innovation and how to do it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at info@projectmedtech.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.